Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Is This Play? Maltese Children's Negotiations of Play in a Drama Classroom. This talk is delivered by Ms. Sharon Attard, lecturer in the Anthropology of Children at University of Malta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and good evening to the radio audience at Campus FM. Tonight we're very happy to introduce Ms. Sharon Attard. Sharon is a lecturer in the Anthropology of Children at the University of Malta. She will be giving a paper entitled, Is This Play? Maltese Children's Negotiations of Play in a Drama Classroom. The paper will explore the play behavior of Maltese children, ranging in age from 5 to 15 years of age, in the context of two prominent drama schools in Malta. Sharon graduated from the University of Malta with an honors degree in anthropology in 2004, and since then she has completed with distinction an MSc in the cross-cultural studies of children, child development and youth at Brunel University in England. Another reason why I'm very happy to introduce somebody who obviously is very keen and successful in her area of study is because I think this is really the very first time in the 13 years in which the Work in Progress seminars have been running that we have a seminar on children, looking at this study of children, the ways children can be studied, and what it is that children actually do. So, Sharon, welcome.
Thank you very much, Paul. So, the paper which I'll be delivering today questions the absolute distinction between play and not play, often confronted within an anthropological consideration of play. I take issue with the theoretical perspective of Gregory Bateson in particular, who approaches the topic assuming that there's a clear distinction between play and not play, based on the taken for granted and prevalent ideas of play in the Western world. The phenomenon of play, in his view, quotes, could only occur if the participant organisms were capable of some degree of metacommunication, i.e. of exchanging signals which would carry the message, this is play. In this regard, unquote, in this regard, play can only exist in as much as the metacommunicative message that sets the play frame is evident and collectively understood. Bateson seems to argue that the means by which the messages are received and the play frames are subsequently set is inherently known due to the metacommunicative nature of the messages themselves, the exception being in cases of schizophrenia, according to Paul. My own fieldwork of two drama schools in Malta seems to suggest that the metacommunicative message, this is play, is not always as obvious and apparent as Bateson makes out. There were moments during my research where the message was left purposely vague by the participating children, so much so that the exchanges which took place appeared to be constructed around the question, is this play? In this article, I explore what happens when the message, this is play, is left purposely ambiguous, such that the question of whether a play situation is actually occurring is unclear to one or more of the participants, who then have to respond according to the message whilst being sure of the, again, quote, levels of abstraction to which the message is meant to belong. In such a situation, what is done to distinguish between play and not play? And is such a clear-cut and fixed distinction between the two even possible? So what I asked is, what goes on in the drama school in terms of a play frame? What underlines many of the existing studies and interpretations of play is the general misleading assumption that notions of what is play and what is not play are universally shared, and that the criteria for distinguishing between the two are unanimously agreed upon and understood by all the respective participants. These studies take for granted the existence of a shared play frame, which leaves no room for uncertainty as to whether or not it is play that is going on. This play frame, as described by Bateson, is said to delimit certain messages and signals, which are self-explanatory and make palpable the play situation at hand, distinguishing it from other forms of interaction. The play frame, in this sense, is simultaneously inclusive and exclusive, in that including some messages into the frame by necessity implies an exclusion of some other messages. In other words, the play frame is that which delimits a logical type, separating what is play from what is not play. During fieldwork in Malta, it became evident that play was not simply an activity which existed for its own sake, as Norbeck argues, but was utilized by the children as a serious medium by which to conduct their affairs. This concept is explored in this paper through the joking patterns of the children and their incorporation of what I call joking insults into their exchanges. These joking insults made manifest the seriousness of play, whilst maintaining the humorous element at its core, therefore essentially incorporating elements of play and not play in its practice. The ambiguity which lay at the heart of this practice is central to this discussion. Given that these joking insults were utilized as a serious social medium for the children, the question arises whether at any given moment the children are playing to pretend or pretending to play. In any given drama exercise, the children at times utilize the notion of pretense in play in order to disguise that which was essentially not play to them as play, and vice versa. Much was hidden in the joking and teasing characteristic of Maltese children, this largely due to the fact that being able to take a joke was seen as a much desired quality for and amongst the children, lest the child becomes one who takes things too seriously. Underlying these displays of pretense, however, should they have been in the form of a joking or playful teasing situation, a play scenario, a game or otherwise, were relationships with one another which were very much founded in reality, despite the overarching presumption that they were just pretending the relationships that they were performing. So much so that many a time, when given a particular improvisation situation to perform by the teacher, what was ultimately enacted was the real relationship of the children to one another, rather than a pretend one. These real relationships were often disguised as play, primarily by nature of the context in which they were conducted. Maintaining some degree of ambiguity was central to the exchanges taking place in order for the fluid relationships involved to be realized as such, and not to fall prey to being taken for granted and assumed as fixed. The central importance of ambiguity is also argued in Trowick and Caroline and Philippa Osella, both of which I'll consider in light of my own research. What becomes evident in the course of this research is that the previously clear boundaries between what is play and what is not play within childhood must necessarily be forfeited in favor of a recognition of the fluid and boundless nature of childhood, whereby the lived experience of what it is to be a child extends to cultural spaces beyond the playground. The nature of the space in which a great deal of the interactions between the children took place was one which was quite particular, and provided the context in which their affairs with one another were to be played out. In paying attention to the social meanings which were being put across in their play situations during the drama lesson, children were seen to explore the possibilities of their social world in which their experience was contextualized, thus calling forth the need for play to be regarded as, quote, just one aspect of the shared repertoire of cultural practices through which children find ways of making some sense of their social encounters with others. That's taken from Alison James. In light of such an obscure distinction between play and not play, I consider how this frame is constructed and negotiated as children make sense of their encounters with one another in ascertaining whether in any given moment they are playing to pretend or pretending to play. The lesson structure varied depending on situations and circumstances within the school. Many a time, however, the children were given the liberty to perform what they liked in terms of improvisation, given that it fell within the instructions that they were given. The children were encouraged to have fun and be creative and to make the most of the task that they were given to do. Moreover, the children often took the opportunity to incorporate prevalent aspects of their current social world into their play, whether they were poking fun at the Maltese singer who came in last in the Eurovision Song Contest 2006, teasing one another's choice of which team to support in the FIFA World Cup 2006, or simply speaking about their upcoming school exams, Holy Communion or Confirmation. Exercises along these lines, in which the children were given relatively more freedom of expression than other lessons would allow, provided an opportunity for children to behave in ways which would generally be reprimanded by adults under normal circumstances. It was not unlikely in these exercises for children to raise their voices at one another, initiate name-calling, or to put on fake accents for comedic effect, as indeed they generally did with one another even when they were not performing some exercise. The children regularly tried to make the rest of the class laugh by using such tactics, amongst others, and they evidently thrived in their success whenever they accomplished this. In one extract from my notes, Andrea and Michelle went first. Michelle sits on a chair with her back straight and her right leg crossed over her left. Andrea adopts a comedic walk and leans against her chair, initiating conversation. He asks her, "How old are you?" And Michelle answers in a well-to-do voice, 35. Andrea exclaims, "That's a lot. Are you posh?" Michelle looks at him incredulously and answers, "Of course." Andrea further asks of her, "Are you from England or France?" And Michelle shouts, "England." The rest of the class seem to be quite amused by this back and forth, judging by their laughter. After a while, Michelle hits Andrea out of mock annoyance, and Andrea falls to the ground, pretending that Michelle has killed him. Marco runs to him from where the rest of the children are sitting and dramatically yells at him, "Wake up!" After they finish, Michelle tells Andrea, "You're really funny." Andrea came to tell me that they were acting as a clown and a lady. Shane and Rebecca went next, acting as a hairdresser and client. Once they were finished, Michelle proclaims, "Ours was funnier." The children placed a great deal of emphasis on humor and seemed to regard the ability to make one another laugh as some sort of social capital. Furthermore, the joking was not only restricted to the children, and the teachers also managed to get in on the act whilst poking fun at the children. Laughter was thus central to the notion of the drama lessons in all its aspects, often being the measure by which a teacher would deem a lesson to have been successful or not. Much focus was placed on the children enjoying themselves, whether it was by means of joking insults or not. For the most part, it appeared that much joy was derived from breaking certain norms and social conventions characteristic of other realms of experience, such as within their academic lessons at school. This was also highlighted by the fact that the teachers tended to join in with the children's laughter and joking, and this even spurred the children on to joke in return with the teachers. Andrew explained that they were going to be pretending to catch jellyfish with a net before almost falling into the sea filled with jellyfish. When he demonstrates to the other, Michael laughs and tells him, "You look like Michael Jackson." There's been a certain lack of attention paid to humor and laughter in anthropology, as though humor in itself threatens the seriousness of life in which the true culture is based. My research lends itself to the understanding that much of the seriousness of life is conducted through the humor of play. Humor should not be regarded as trivial and as decontextualized from and disruptive to the feedback process simply by means of its presence. Rather, it offers insight into and brings forward the key elements of a group's sociality in the way that humor is conducted and dealt with. It was often in those instances of humor, amongst others, that the Maltese children I observed brought together their lived experience of the world and utilized play as a medium through which they could express their concerns with one another in terms of what they took to be the most salient features of their social environment, itself contextualizing their own experiences. Overing's comments on Amazonian humor and sociality would be equally applicable here, in that, quote, "Laughter and the ludic obviously play a large part in the everyday life of these people, so much so that it becomes an important clue to the very distinctiveness of their sociality." As the previous extracts have shown, there are certain teasing elements that form part of joking with one another, and this is something which also extends to Maltese adults. Inasmuch as a person is highly regarded for being able to entertain his or her peers, the same is true of being able to take what I deem as a joking insult without offense. A child who takes offense or who fails to react to a joke in a favorable way tends to either be disliked by the other children or to stand at the margins of whatever activity happens to be going on. It is evident here that a sense of humor is highly desired, if not necessary quality for the children to have, and that a sense of humor implies being able to tackle joking insults, given that they are a constant feature of Maltese humor. The children would generally have had some degree of familiarity with one another before joking insults would be initiated into their relationship, by virtue of being friends at school or having attended the drama classes together for a while. The children found many opportunities to take shots at one another with the aim of getting the other children to laugh. The person at whom the insult is aimed would ideally retort with something equally amusing, as each child goes back and forth, trying to outdo the other in their mocking yet humorous replies. So, Miss Annalise takes two chairs and places them together. The children ask, "Is this of the bus?" And Miss Annalise answers yes, to which the children cheer with delight and argue as to who gets to go first. In this exercise, one person goes up on the bus first and takes a seat, and after a short while, a second person goes up and sits beside them, invading their space in some way. Emma and Christina are chosen to go up first, and once they are seated, their conversation goes as follows. So Emma begins by pretending to be painting her nails. "Christina, must you do that on the bus?" "I'm a professional." "You're spilling. Your nails are disgusting." Smiling happily, "Thanks. Where are you from?" "Nashar." "So you're a Hamalla." "You are." "You want to hear my life story? I was in a plane crash." "You look like Mrs. Bucket." Pause. "Do you know what's annoying? When people go like this," and she puts her finger in her mouth and put it in the other girl's ear. And the other girl initially had a look of shock on her face, but then quickly composed herself and retorted with, "You know what's annoying you?" And Emma smiled back and said, "I know." So in this respect, much delight is taken in coming up with a clever comeback to an insult, or being able to turn an insult into a compliment in some way. In the strategies which they adopt, the children aim to minimize the damage of the insult which is directed at them and to maximize the impact of their own joking insults in order to come out of the exchange more triumphant than their sparring partner. The rest of the class, on this occasion, as they always did, laughed out loud at this performance and showed their appreciation for a particularly good comeback with claps and comments such as, "That was a good one." Many a time, each child in the class would be rooting for one child rather than another, depending on their friendships and loyalties with the children in question. The teacher watched the performance with similar amusement, and the whole affair is regarded as a fun and enjoyable exercise for the children to indulge in. Christina and Emma both formed part of Group 2 and were also good friends with one another, regularly speaking to each other during the lesson and in break. In this respect, joking insults are simply integrated into the witty repartee which the children engage in. Nothing is thought of it, and it is not taken seriously by anyone as a serious argument between the girls. The exchange is protected by virtue of being considered play, since they are only pretending, and thus they are not reprimanded for their behavior by the teacher as they would be had the exchange taken place in a different context. The joking relationship outlined above with Christina and Emma is fairly common amongst all the drama schools which I observed. Both girls were equally aware that the exchange which took place would not be damaging to their friendship and seemed to be fairly confident that it was indeed play that was going on, without having to expressly state that fact to one another. To this extent, one could say that Bateson is indeed correct in his argument regarding the existence of the metacommunicative signal "this is play." However, the introduction of ambiguity into the situation at times seemed to render this signal unintelligible to the other participants. It was very much accepted that one would joke amongst friends in the class, much in the same way that Christina and Emma did. However, an uncertainty arose when joking insults were exchanged amongst those children who were not particularly close to one another, were not very well acquainted, or outrightly disliked each other. Where joking insults were exchanged between children who displayed a certain animosity towards one another in all aspects of their relationship, rendering the situation at hand as being exclusively one of play, becomes problematic, as the following extract shows here. So, the boys were put into two groups of three. Mike arrived late and had to be placed in a group. Both groups argued over him, saying, "He's ours, no, he's ours." Mike eventually joined the group that had John, an unpopular boy in the class. As they were discussing what to do, one of the boys in the group looked to John and told him, "We don't want you." John attempted to join in with the discussion and told the others, "I'm Dracula," as he began trying to take charge. Jason pushed him away. John offered a compromise to his group in deciding who would be Dracula, telling them, "Let's toss a coin." The other boys ignore him and decide on their own that Jason will be Dracula. They are clearly very impatient with John. There's much disagreement as to how to perform the script that was given to them, and they eventually choose to make up a script of their own. As they are discussing it, Jason comments to the teacher, "Andrew, this group sucks." And John complains to Andrew, telling him, "I only have one line." When they eventually came to perform their play, John began by walking up to Mike, who was playing Dracula Jr., and asking, "Did you get lunch?" Mike answered, "Of course I did, idiot." The above insult directed at John during their performance was done in a situation of play, and as a result would technically have no bearing in reality, given the element of pretense which is generally characteristic of play. However, given the exchanges which occurred amongst the boys prior to the performance, it is evident that their real relationships with each other and the emotions of animosity towards John are not far removed from the play situation in which he was referred to as an idiot. The play situation seems to provide a safe context by which the children can express true feelings which they have for one another without any consequences, the context itself rendering the exchange as unreal or invalid. Yet what is being put across in play mirrors that which is going on in not play, such as in the above example, and what is enacted is precisely their real relationship to one another. Is it still possible to distinguish between play and not play in a judicious manner? Similarly, the previous two examples provided of the two pairs of girls show them getting along with one another well in their play scenes, demonstrating how their play is also closely linked to the reality of the social relationship outside the play frame. Evidently, these very real relationships are strongly present and underlie whatever is occurring in the children's performance, which seems to suggest that play is better thought of as social action, rather than a social phenomenon existing separately from reality, as some studies would suggest. rather than being an activity which exists for its own sake, it becomes increasingly clear that play exists as a serious social medium for the children, whereby their encounters with one another in this context provides a means for social action in a predominantly child-based setting. What has been demonstrated thus far are manifestations of joking insults within the drama class situation, which superficially take on similar forms in terms of style and content. In a consideration of the relationships which lie at their base, however, it becomes clear that delineating certain exchanges as play and others as not play is increasingly difficult, and it begs the question of how and if Bateson's play frame within the drama schools is to be conceptualized. The relationships described thus far, Emma and Christina, as well as Jason, Mike and John, represent to some degree the different ends of a range of variations in terms of what children's experiences of friendships could be. And these relationships in themselves cannot be regarded as permanently fixed. I regularly observed relationships between the children, where they would go from complete avoidance of one another one week to being best of friends in the next week. Despite the differing nature of these friendships, they are put across in similar ways in their performance. Although the aspects of these performances took on much of the same outer form, I would be very reluctant to agree that all three exchanges fall within play as opposed to not play. Matters are further complicated in regarding relationships which generally fall somewhere between friendship and animosity. In such a situation, where the nature of friendship remains ambiguous for some reason, and this is often the case given the fluctuating nature of their relationships, joking insults tend to oscillate between the two possible interpretations of friendly banter and making a dislike of one another known. It's often difficult to ascertain the way in which the insult is intended, and many a time the children attempt to work this out whilst the exchange is still in progress, as they carefully calculate the responses in a way that they feel is appropriate to the situation. So Krista and Veronica were chosen for the next improvisation situation, and they were told that Krista had to call up Veronica and tell her, "I have the world's biggest secret." The conversation goes as follows. "Hello? Hi, it's me, Krista." "Krista?" "Yes, Krista." "Who?" "The English girl." "Oh, right. What?" "Well, I have something to tell you." "Tell me." "Well, it's a really big secret, and, just tell me." "I don't know what it is. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I have to do my homework." "I don't think I can tell you." At this point, Miss Annelise quickly interrupts to remind Veronica that she really wants to know what the secret is. "Tell me what your secret is." "Well, just tell me, please." "Well, I'm not sure. I don't know if I can. By the way, I have a nice new nickname to call you." "What?" "Cockroach." "I'm going to hang up." Krista pretends to hang up the phone and then calls Veronica back. "Hello. Hi, I'm not your friend." "Okay, Cockroach, if you're not my friend, I don't mind." "Well, I called to tell you a secret. I like ice cream." "Okay, no, that's not it." "Or is it a bee that you found in your ear?" "Krista, yes, that's it. Okay, my secret is I don't do my homework." "What?" At this point, Krista starts to look very, very worried. "Okay, that's not my secret. Okay, bye." Krista pretends to hang up the phone, and this time Veronica calls her back. "Tell me your secret. That was my secret. Tell me." "I can't. I don't have it. I thought I could, but I can't." "Oh, come on. You have to. You have to tell me. Come on. I'm bored." And then Krista says, "Okay, it's that I don't like you. I don't know. I can't tell you." At this point, Miss Annelise stops their turn in order to send up the other two children to go next. In this improvisation, Krista clearly has difficulty in coming up with what to say is her secret. This improvisation situation is particularly interesting for many reasons. Veronica, the girl who initiated joking insults into the exchange with the introduction of the nickname Cockroach, was not, from what I had observed, a girl who often engaged in teasing, and in this instance was not provoked to do so by means of having to respond to something that Krista had said. Veronica was a relatively shy and soft-spoken girl the majority of the time, and having overheard two older girls in the class refer to her as stupid behind her back on one occasion led me to believe that she herself was teased from time to time. Krista was also a very shy and introverted girl from the impression I had of her, and her poor attendance at the lessons made it difficult to ascertain over time the nature of her relationship to Veronica. The two had shown neither signs of friendship nor of hostility towards one another, thus rendering their relationship somewhat ambiguous. Situations such as this raise the question of what lies behind the exchange. Was Veronica's introduction of joking insults intended as a display of friendship, a revelation of her dislike for Krista, or a temporary disassociation from Krista due to a somewhat failing performance? This question appears to be one which Krista herself attempts to answer in the course of the conversation. Her responses range from giving Veronica chances to redeem herself by expressing disapproval of what Veronica had told her, such as telling Veronica that she was going to hang up and then promptly calling her back, to responding to Veronica's insults by telling her, "I'm not your friend and I don't like you." Veronica in turn minimizes the damage, doing so with the former statement by saying that she doesn't mind if Krista is not her friend. She did not have adequate opportunity to respond to the latter statement. Krista's tactic in dealing with these responses is relatively neutral, as she attempts to gauge what is meant by the insults directed at her, in the midst of being slightly thrown off by them and being somewhat lost for words in terms of what to say. As the improvisation is in progress, she attempts to negotiate the play frame with Veronica in trying to gain insight as to whether they were engaging in play or not play. The boundaries between the two, as we have seen thus far, are relatively obscure in practice. It seems to be impossible to determine one particular exchange as play or not play, as the play frame appears to be negotiated from moment to moment in such a way that one single conversation may hold constant fluctuations between the two. The potential elusiveness accompanying the message "this is play" is one which may unconsciously be so strong that some children on a few occasions choose to confirm their intentions vocally in order to eliminate any element of ambiguity which they feel may have been present and make the signals which were exchanged explicitly known. The danger of misconstruing play signals, or perhaps a fear of having these signals misconstrued, is often present and is dealt with accordingly. This is done depending on the unique nature of each particular encounter, one of which I outline here in just a moment. I'm going to refrain from reading this in the accent, but the gist is there. So, putting on a strong American accent, "The seat is like reserved for a friend. There's the rest of the bus." Erica ignores her and laughs out loud at a magazine which she's pretending to read. "Bernadette, you're reading a stupid magazine. You should be reading Shout." Both girls then begin doing things to disgust one another. Each girl pretends to spit and cough over the other, and they also pick their noses and stick their fingers in their ears in taking out the earwax and wiping it on one another. "Bernadette, you're the girl who's disgusting and ew at school." Erica says, "I'm like older than you." "Bernadette, you're like 11. "Bernadette, I don't know who you're talking to. I am Bernadette." Erica says, "Yeah, I've heard of her. Her hair is so last year." Again, keeping the very strong American accent. Miss Annalise stops them at this point in order to allow another group to go up. When they are finished, Erica turns to Bernadette and tells her, "Don't worry, honey, I love you and your hair is very nice," and gives her a hug as the two girls laugh. Bernadette was a very popular girl in class. She was funny, humorous and energetic, and often joked with me and included me in her teasing. Erica is one of Bernadette's closest friends, and the two form part of the same as we say Maltese clique. As a result, they generally tease and make fun of one another, as can be seen in the beginning of the above extract. Given their close friendship and the fact that this particular encounter didn't differ much from the banter they often engage with one another, it's likely that Bernadette thought nothing of what was said and didn't consider that it may have constituted not play. Nonetheless, Erica chooses not to chance a misunderstanding, given the delicate balance which exists between play and not play. Suffice it to say, for the purposes of this distinction, that play and not play exist side by side, at times in an indistinguishable and complementary relationship to one another, to such an extent that the ambiguity of any play situation, even those friendships that are mostly, though not always, solid at its base, at times needs to be addressed. In these lessons, it's evident that children are given freedom to explore the potentials of their social world in a socially accepted way, drawing attention to what is most significant to them in playing out what they take to be some of the salient features of their lived experiences with one another. The ability to do so is drawn upon by themselves in a highly creative way, and is not simply given to them by virtue of being in an atmosphere which is conducive to play. What has been clearly demonstrated and made evident thus far is that play is highly creative, and is very much utilized as a serious social medium for the children. The seriousness of play has been brought about elsewhere, as in the work of Briggs, which was previously mentioned. In mentioning this element of play, Briggs draws attention to the socialization value of play, and how by means of its non-serious and yet simultaneously serious nature, play is utilized as the primary vehicle for the internalization of important values amongst the Inuit. Play is seen amongst the Inuit as a safe and controlled form of expression, where serious and potentially dangerous feelings may be communicated safely under the guise of playfulness, thus providing a safe outlet for the dangerous feeling. A playful person is one who knows how to joke with others and who doesn't take things too seriously. Such a person is considered as a good, happy and safe person amongst the Inuit, and thus has possession of izuma, which is reason, maturity and sense, in being able to control their positive and negative emotions. This is the attitude which adults hope to foster amongst Inuit children in playing these games with them. The notion of a safe play context in which negative emotions are communicated in a protected environment is in a sense carried over in the Maltese drama classroom. Negative emotions are not confronted directly and at surface value seem to succumb to the demands of the adult conditioned environment. What Briggs fails to note in her ethnography is the agency of the children within the environment and the innovative way in which they choose to engage in play. Briggs tends to unwittingly depict the children involved as passive recipients of their own learning, unquestioningly taking in and relying on that being indirectly taught to them by adults. Although children are alluded to as active participants in this kind of play, Briggs focuses her attention upon what the adults are attempting to teach and put across to the children. What certain ethnographic examples within the text seem to suggest, and which isn't fully brought out in the analysis, is that play seems to give children the opportunity to really test and push the boundaries of what is and what is not deemed as acceptable behavior, and to do so to a great extent without the fear of being reprimanded. This, to an extent, is what is going on in the Maltese drama classrooms. In the predominant presumption that whatever goes on in the classroom is play, children are given license to explore the adult structured conditions of their existence and to act upon it as integral social actors of the world to which they belong, learning and transforming themselves into effective joking Maltese adults in a process of becoming and acting on the play situation at hand in bringing together their social experiences with one another. In terms of the children engaging in joking insults, parallels may be drawn here with Miller's account of Pikong and giving fatigue, in that while Pikong remains good-humoured, it is indulged in as a competitive practice which has the potential to turn nasty. Care is taken to ensure that what is said and done remains framed within the canons of accepted humour. It has been demonstrated thus far that the Maltese children observed often do incorporate elements of the competitive in their joking insults, although they appear to be more flexible and in control in terms of framing what is said and done as humorous play or otherwise. As in Gilsonen's study of Yatmara performances, whether exchanges of gestural and verbal violence were to be taken as playful or serious were questions which emerged in practice. Frames of social action have to be established and maintained frequently by collective effort and complicity. The exchanges outlined by Gilsonen are not predetermined as playful or serious from the outset of the debate. Their very nature becomes apparent in the course of the exchange, establishing the frame in the process. Whether or not it was indeed Yatmara which would have gone on could be debated at times, and as such falls victim on occasion to conflicting definition. In engaging in this practice, it is important for the participants to acknowledge the playful character of the dispute, and thus to react appropriately when insults are issued, despite the nature of the insult, otherwise posing a threat to the frame once it has already been established in some way. Despite the playful nature of the discussion, however, what goes on in the debate often has an effect upon the reputation of the participants involved in some way, thus underlining the place of the playful Yatmara in the serious matters of everyday life. Cross-cultural similarities can indeed be drawn in this case between Gilsonen's Lebanese ethnographic example and the ethnographic material from Malta, particularly with regard to the ambiguity surrounding the nature of the occurring exchange as playful or seriousness. As Gilsonen points out, Yatmara might have a special quality of ambiguity. Because what was made the subject of the argument was indeed serious and was almost bound to be subject to varying interpretation and vigorously defended, play on this ambiguity, play on play, as such, gave plenty of scope for virtuosity in performance. This play on play, in which the elements of play and serious are superimposed on one another and made ambiguous, opens up the encounter to a negotiation in the case of the Maltese children. Interpretations may vary from one moment to the next as to what is actually going on, and to this end, the play frame remains somewhat compliant to the negotiating situation at hand, and unstable when the participants involved fail to establish whether it is play or not play that is going on. The element of ambiguity has arisen elsewhere in anthropological inquiries, such as Caroline and Filippo Osella's consideration of friendship and flirting in Kerala, South India. The Othellos describe how ambiguity regarding the intentions of the participants is carefully maintained, and reference is made to the possibilities and significance of play which flirting often induces. The Othellos put forward the argument of Simmel in their discussion in his regard of flirting as a game which is spurred on by the continuous and simultaneous presence of denial and acceptance. A certain amount of ambivalence is characteristic of the encounter, as a balance is struck between reality and pretense, between having and not having. Despite the play-like quality which is characteristic of it, there's an understanding of flirting as a game whose instrument is reality. And that's a quote from Simmel. Thus, attention is drawn to the fact that whilst an element of play is present in the exchange, it is still reality which underlines the game that is being played. Therefore, rather than being engaged in simply for the sake of play, it is seen that flirting acts out a wider existential condition. In applying this argument to the ethnographic material provided by Maltese children, certain similarities become apparent, one of which would be in terms of the maintenance of ambiguity in their interactions. Another could be seen in the fact that whilst the overriding assumption in the drama classroom is that the children are pretending their relationships to one another in their improvisations, there are nonetheless very real relationships which underlie the exchanges which go on. Play is never devoid of the reality with which it plays, despite the ambiguity which attempts to both hide it and allude to it at the same time. Trawick also considers ambiguity and flexibility, doing so in relation to how it lies at the core of the social world of a family in Tamil Nadu, in their understanding and appropriation of what love is and means to them. Reference is made to how children learn the principles of theatrics and the disguising and blurring of true relations and identities. Tamil children are seen to treasure the secrecy of an identity, borrowing from the importance of keeping things hidden, which is evidently so prevalent in their Tamil world. The inherent ambiguity of love in Tamil Nadu is crucial to an understanding of the social world of the children, carrying out their own process of becoming in a world where no singular meaning exists for any one event. The Maltese children were also very aware of the inherent ambiguity characteristic of their world inside the drama classroom, the multiplicity of possible meanings behind their words and actions causing doubt as to their underlying intentions. Some appeared to revel in this, keeping their feelings and relationships hidden by nature of the play situation which facilitated this ambiguity. Whilst there were some who delighted in the secrecy of pretense, there were others who felt the need to remove uncertainty from their encounters and to make evident the meanings which were intended. Either way, the ambiguity within the drama classroom is accepted as given and forms part of the conditions of existence which shape the lived experiences of the children. The children act within the conditions of existence in their social world, making meaning of their world and of their relationships which encompasses in the process. Their individual histories are brought together in a lived experience of the same spatio-temporal dimension of their drama classroom, though there is no way the extent of the lived experiences which come to make them who they are, both as individuals and as Maltese children in their particular localized cultures. The way in which children act and within their conditions of existence in making their own meaning of the world is replicated to some degree in the argument of Corsaro regarding the significance of discursive practices in formulating an understanding of what friendship is within a particular community. Discursive practices within the Maltese context are seen to an extent in light of the phenomenon of Ana in Malta, referred to extemporized song duels widely regarded as Maltese traditional folk singing. Suddenly describes the phenomenon of the Ana in detail, particularly the genre of spirit pront with which it is generally associated, in which two men improvise on the spot in trying to best one another in argument accompanied by two guitars. The subject of the argument is usually chosen in the course of the song, and those participating will attempt to ridicule their opponent by means of subtle insults or by turning insults made against them into compliments, a skill which is highly prized. Honor, as characteristic of anthropological studies of the Mediterranean, is often at stake during the Ana and must be protected. Despite the exchange of insults, as well as the need to protect one's honor, a joking character is constantly maintained. Suddenly argues that the Ana is not merely traditional folk singing as it has so been romanticized by those of Maltese middle and upper classes, but rather a reaction of the working class to the contemporary Maltese political situation. Despite the exchange of insults in the course of Ana, certain measures are taken to detract from any seriousness in the insults, and laughing is permitted in order to maintain a joking and light-hearted character. it is considered a good quality for an Anne to be a good joker. Although, ironically, this also means that he is capable of issuing very witty insults and that care should be taken not to cross him. There appear to be many similarities between the cultural practice of Anna and the discursive practices brought forward by the children in their drama lessons. Though it might be argued that their play points to a dominant social cultural genre being reproduced to some extent in their own version of an adult... reproduced to some extent in their own version of an adult form of an agnostic context, it is important to note that many of the children involved in my study would not have had any direct experience of the Anna. However, despite this lack of direct experience of the Anna, its practice seems to be quite indicative of the joking patterns of the Maltese in general. Their appropriation of it should not be seen as a mere reproduction of adult joking patterns, but as assigning their own meaning to aspects of their social world in new and innovative ways. The way in which they do so is unique to them. The process itself bringing out the agency of the children as social actors in their own right, acting on the world and making sense of it as they go along. So in order to sum up, there can be no universal and predetermined set of criteria for what actions are to be considered play and what actions are not. The phenomenon of play is not one which can be clearly defined and must be considered in light of what the activity means to those who are practicing it. It has been demonstrated that play is a serious social medium for the children in which their affairs are conducted and their relationships with one another are played out, thus arguing against the idea of play as an activity pursued for its own sake. The element of seriousness which is present in the children's play is such that it underlines the fact that there can be no clear distinction between what is play and what is not. Bateson argues for the existence of a play frame which delineates activities of play from activities of not play and communicates this distinction clearly to all relevant participants. What I have argued is that this distinction cannot be taken as given and is never fixed nor constant from one moment to the next. If a play frame is to be operative at all, it must be recognized as having borders which are fluid and somewhat obscure and blurry. It is continuously constructed and reconstructed by the children and is not given by means of a preconceived understanding and agreement of it. Rather, it is negotiated and renegotiated continuously in the course of the children's interactions and can even be reinterpreted after the fact. Play does not exist simply by virtue of being in a particular spatio-temporal dimension which is conducive to play. Indeed, the environment in which the drama lessons took place cannot be conceptualized as one which is exclusive to play, as it is nonetheless structured around the idea of being a lesson where children are expected to work at what is asked of them. Rather than existing as a pre-given phenomenon, the play frame is manipulated by children in an evident manifestation of their own social agency. Due to the fluid nature of the constantly fluctuating play frame, uncertainty often arose amongst the children as to whether or not they were actually playing, thus raising the question, is this play between them? The metacommunicative messages, Bateson, indicating the play frame were left vague, at times leading to conflicting interpretations of these messages and further need for negotiation of the play frame. On occasion, the play frame was taken for granted by the children themselves, and they confidently assumed that their play signals were clearly understood by one another and that their own play frame had been clearly agreed upon. Indeed, there were times when the children were correct in their assumptions, although for the most part, the inherent ambiguity of the play frame, coupled with the resulting potential for disagreement, was acknowledged and addressed through various means. Some chose to take advantage of the ambiguities of their play, at times keeping their intentions hidden and delighting in the resulting confusion, while some at others made their intentions known and explicit for fear of being misunderstood. The ambiguity which was characteristic of the play situation of the Maltese children that I observed was such that it allowed the children to develop the means by which to respond to it in their own innovative ways. The children were able to develop a feel for the game when it came to negotiating the play frame, confronting its fluctuating nature, and conducting their own serious social affairs in the process. Play was never divorced from the reality with which it played, and the two remained complementary to one another in an ongoing relationship. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sharon, for focusing on what is a new topic in the Work in Progress series. And giving us some very interesting examples for reflection in terms of the argument which you put forward about the nature of what kids are doing when they seem to be playing. Your argument and your use of your examples does depend upon your being able to distinguish what would be a play situation for them and what we might call their normal interaction. So I think the audience might like to learn a little bit about your research method. How did you interact with the kids outside of the play frame so that when it came to the play frame, you were able to get a clearer insight as to how much play was going on?
Well, as I mentioned, the play frame tended to go in and out of it without even myself realizing it. At the time, I was a little younger, perhaps closer in age to them, and there was a certain confidence with which some of the older children approached me. Given that I came from the same kind of background, they felt comfortable approaching me. However, one of the things which, to address one of your earlier questions, the research methods which I adopted were ethnographic research methods, given that I am an anthropologist as my background. However, given that you are dealing with children as a subject matter in this respect, there are certain issues to be aware of when conducting such research. Obviously, the generational gap is there. You can't pretend that it isn't. But what has to be done is that you have to acknowledge it, along with any other possible limitations which may come around in anthropology. And obviously, just adopt a reflexive approach in which you acknowledge these possible hindrances and take them into account in terms of the research which you are actually able to do. With regards to their acceptance of me, I found that this very easily came along once I actually joined in terms of their joking insults, and once I showed myself to be somebody who was capable of making a joke and also taking a joke. So I would also encourage them to come to me with their jokes, and I would laugh along whenever they did that. And one of the ways in which I then sort of started to feel it accepted as such by my informants would be when they started to integrate me themselves into their instances of play. And off the top of my head, one situation which is coming to mind is when they enacted a scene from Eurovision Song Contest in 2006, which was the year that Finland won with the entrance of Lordi. And they created an E-True Hollywood story as such of where Sharon and Lordi met and fell in love, which was something which spurred on obviously a lot of laughter and joking amongst the in the class, and it wasn't the only situation of this happening. And the way that I reacted to it and responded to those situations within my specific research methods obviously gave me numerous opportunities in which to elicit more feedback and data from my informants in this respect and to be accepted as one of them to a certain extent.
Well, thank you very much, Aaron. I very much enjoyed this. Couple of questions, please, because I was thinking about this, the title of your paper, which is this play, because, and I think it's a wonderful title, and it is also wonderful because actually what's happening over there is that they're supposed to be acting out theatre. So I'm just wondering whether there is a bit of ambiguity between the normal type of play that children have in a playground and the play that they're having over here, which is also a play that is theatre. Because when they are enacting certain types of roles, there's in this case, you have a sort of, there's a type of script in a way that they have to enact. It's a bit more complex. I mean, if you take kids playing around in a playground, that's one thing. If you take them acting out certain roles, it becomes even more complex. because, and I'll tell you, at least how it seems to me, to what is happening over there. I mean, play as theatre, you have a script, a sort of minimal script. It's set for them. They're deviating from it. It's always triadic in the sense that, you know, you have to become an alter. You have to become somebody else. You have to act, and it's something which is set for you. They deviate a bit from this because they come in and out of that. And that is, in a way, the critical part over here, because you have to become an author, somebody else. It's a bit uncertain to the other kids whether that is actually taking place. So there's a type of intersubjective doubt over there. You know, is it the role that is this girl is taking on, or is it her? And they're playing around on that. And mind reading is very uncertain. You know, usually when we have play, we sort of go along with it. As adults, people develop that sort of, or even children, I suspect, I don't really know, but they develop a sort of skill in mind reading, going along with it. So we quickly enter into a new sort of intersubjectivity where we're reading each other and we're going along. Whereas over here, it's a bit ambiguous. So there is uncertainty inherent in this context, and quite more so, I suspect, that when children are playing around in a playground. And I think it might be worthwhile to think about it a bit more, because you've got quite a complex situation over here. I mean, because is this play, could also play, is this the play that they're supposed to be doing, or is it their play that they are enacting?
Okay, just to clarify with regards to the title, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the paper, I take issue with Bateson's particular theory. And the article which Bateson wrote was, "This is play." So what I intended to do with that title was essentially turn it on its head, because the statement of Gregory Bateson was very final, outlining specifically, "This is play. This is what is considered as play." And what I try to do for the purposes of this paper is, as I said, turn it on its head and actually question, well, is it? So this is what this paper essentially attempts to do. With regards to the lesson context, I do agree with you in the sense that the drama lessons in themselves, it's inevitable. One of the things to be aware of in this particular type of research is the fact that whilst children are social actors and make sense of their own social environment and social world, essentially the experiences of their social world are essentially within an adult structured context. So this is very true with regards to these particular lessons, and it is more structured than, as you say, playground and free play might be, which in that case, that kind of play might be less interrupted by adults. That said, the particular lessons which I observed still had a degree of freedom to it, in the sense that they weren't given a strict script as such to act out. What they were given was a particular situation where they were just given a frame as such, a situation, and they had to take it from there. So, for example, they would be told that one of you has to get up on the bus, and then another person gets up on the bus and take it from there. So what they chose to do within that time would essentially be up to them completely. So whilst there is some degree of this play being structured by adults in the sense that they give them some sort of guidance and direction, it still very much has a degree of freedom in it in terms of what they actually say to one another, the words which they use, and what they choose to do.
Thanks for your presentation. One question I had was whether the children are actually encouraged to come up with these conflicts, or whether these conflicts come up as a natural part of the exercise. I mean, I'm aware that if these children would agree on everything and, you know, be really nice, that would make for a really boring theater. However, I'm also interested in whether the persons organizing the exercise, the teachers or the facilitators, whether they have a particular intention in mind in bringing out these conflicts, and whether there is any resolution exercise afterwards.
Well, within the context of my research, I never witnessed any of these incidents actually being encouraged by teachers. That said, they were not discouraged either. What the teachers would do would give a very, very vague scenario for them to act out and then allow a certain amount of freedom. They might encourage them in the sense that sometimes they might give a scenario which might be conducive as such to these kinds of joking insults. For example, the one of the bus, the exercise of the bus was one where they were told to do things to invade one another's space in some way. However, the dialogue which followed from that was completely improvised in that respect. So some scenarios might lend themselves a little more to joking insults. However, they were never explicitly encouraged in that respect. And the teachers very much allowed a certain degree of freedom in this respect. There were a few times where a teacher might step in and actually stop an exchange, such as, for example, the last one which I put up, no, it's not the last one, where a teacher actually stopped the two girls who were discussing one another, one called another a cockroach and so on. She interfered and stopped it because she felt as though it wasn't getting anywhere and that the insults were a little too forthcoming. But, I mean, to answer your question, it was never directly encouraged in that respect. What I put this down to, though, is also the fact that the teachers themselves similarly prized joking insults to some degree, because as I mentioned, the teachers themselves would also be incorporated into these kinds of joking insults, like at the very beginning where a boy told the teacher that he looks like Michael Jackson because he pretended to be picking jellyfish out of the sea. And I think similarly to my own experiences, I don't think that that was entirely looked down upon by the teachers, because like myself, I think they may have regarded it as somewhat of a form of acceptance as well, obviously within context and within limits, but that is how I tend to perceive it.
And were there any occasions where the limits were overstepped? I think the case you mentioned earlier, the Dracula case, where somebody was called idiot and it was highly reflective of what was really going on. Do you feel that sort of situation might lead to any problems which the teachers might need to deal with after the exercise?
Not explicitly, specifically because I think the exchange was somewhat protected by the nature of being considered play, as in whilst there were real relationships underlying it, it sort of provided a little bit of a buffer, as it were. A situation never got so out of hand that the teacher had to stop everything and address everything. And that said, the drama classes which I observed were ones where the teachers were not their regular school teachers. It was almost an after-school program. So there was little interaction between the teachers and the children outside of the context of the classroom. So it wasn't dealt with within the classroom. I mean, there was very little reaction, any very little interaction going on outside of the classroom to deal with this issue.
My apologies for having missed quite a part of this talk. I was detained because of work commitments. So I don't know if you have already addressed this issue. But I was quite interested in the comparison you made with the ANA. Now, I know the ANA's taken up a lot of space in Maltese anthropology and sort of, you know, when is it a play or is it more than that, the trading insults bit. So you see this as what the children enact in a play, let's call it a semi-structured play, right? Because you just said that, I mean, you give them the opening part, but then they do actually add to the plot and to its development. Do you see this as very symptomatic of a Maltese cultural trait that, you know, this idea that through play and through joking, we can trade insults and, we're supposed to accept it. You're supposed to be a sport and accept it because it's all part of a play, even though it's speaking some you know, some really, really, there's an element of violence going on there, because some people can speak some home truths to you through joking, and that's something which happens also later on when we're grown up, you know, as grown-ups.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned with regards to the Ana, it was a very small part of the paper, and to be honest, the reason that it was introduced was because the number of similarities which I perceived between the two was quite astounding, particularly given the fact that, as far as I'm aware, the children that I observed within my fieldwork would have had very, very little, if any, experience of the Ana. So I found this quite fascinating that they seem to adopt very similar styles as such and patterns without having any direct experience of it. To be perfectly honest, I see that as being more food for thought than anything else. I don't propose to know exactly what is going on there and if there is a link between them, if any. But the number of similarities between the two and the strategies which they adopt in dealing with it were quite astounding. And I wanted to sort of to put that forward even for further comments by the participants here, even because I do find it very fascinating that such a link can exist without having direct experience of it, because it would be very easy to say that children were mindlessly or sort of reproducing adult patterns or just imitating them as such. That tends to be a mistake which many make with regards to studying children, believing that children passively imitate that which the adults around them do. In this case, I believe it as very much an example of how children are social actors in this particular sense, that they actively make their own sense of what's going on without necessarily passively imitating what goes on with the adults.
Could it be also, I share your point, because I don't think they will be exposed to Ana. And there's the other side of Maltese popular culture, which is the farsa, which also has this kind of trading insults things. I wonder, first of all, when it does take this turn, where children in the semi-structured play start trading insults, whether it also derives from the fact, this is just, I'm just reading, thinking aloud here, that the other person, the children are acting, they're pretending, and some of the pretenses could be very, very ambitious. And you don't see yourself, but you see the other as a child. And this guy is pretending to be somebody, I don't know, Prince Charming or something like that. And that immediately provokes a kind of insulting comment. So who the hell do you think you are, sort of? And the thing is that probably the children themselves are not realizing that they themselves are doing this. So they're only seeing the other. You know, well, this is the world of make-believe. They try to play the part of something that they might aspire to. And the other person who's doing the same thing, after all, as a child, you know, but, you know, children, how it is, they don't see themselves, they see the other, and they see this as being too pretentious and too ambitious and, you know, maybe out of sync with what they perceive the person to be. And that immediately then provokes a kind of sarcastic, sardonic, whatever, comment.
Could be. Well, I mean, as a practice in itself, it is something which only makes sense in relation to the other. In order to be able to engage in this practice, it's very much dependent on the sort of simultaneous back and forth which goes on. I honestly wouldn't know how to answer that, to be perfectly honest. What I would suggest is that it's suggestive of a discursive pattern, and rather than amongst the Maltese, and perhaps rather than actually sort of trying to come off as something that they're not, it's just a sparring whereby they're constantly trying to up one another, and the main focus over there, I would suggest, is the performance element, as Paul Sancastri mentioned, the fact that they are performing this in front of an audience. So the audience element is quite strong with regards to this, and taking away that element might, I mean, I imagine it would change the whole entire scenario and the whole pattern.
I was going to ask a similar question to Peter. I think you've got to be a bit careful there with this idea that children do not passively imitate adults. I realize why you say it, but on the other hand, it is perhaps striking that you can point to analogies between Anna as a performance and this observed form of children's semi-structured play, to use Peter's example. And it's that kind of analogy which is suggestive. Did you, in pointing to this area of joking insult, did you feel that there were contrasts between the kind of play you were observing and the kinds of play you were reading about in other societies? Did you find there was a difference between the kind of play you observed in your research and the kind of play you were reading about in other societies, such as the Inuit, or, in other words, were joking insults lacking, for example, in studies of children's play
places? The studies which I chose specifically were ones which incorporated elements of joking insults, specifically ethnographic examples whereby the seriousness of play was stressed. So if I were to take the example of the Inuit, this was in fact stressed as something being very important for the Inuit, that they teach a lot of the seriousness of life through play in such a way, as I mentioned, whereby the play situation and the play scenario protects them from the possible negative repercussions of expressing negative opinions. What I criticize in that particular study, the thing which I find lacking from there, is the fact that attention was not paid to what the children themselves were actually understanding from that. We, as anthropologists, tend to focus very much on what the adults are attempting to impart on their children, as though it's a very sort of straightforward process whereby sort of information from one individual is transmitted to the other. And I would argue that it's very much not the case. With regards to my statement that children don't passively imitate adults, I would argue that children make their own meaning of the situations that they are in. Granted, the situations that they are in are very heavily structured by the adults around them. Their existence is essentially adult structured, with, you know, down to which school they go to, how their schedule after school is sort of distributed, which private lessons to go to, where to play, and so on and so forth. So whilst adults very heavily structure the timetable as such of the children, and it's done in such a way that children do end up having similar, though not identical, ideas to their parents. But this is precisely because they make their own meaning of their situation, and eventually the adult structured existence amongst them actually makes sense to them. They actually understand it because they have no reason to question it. They have no reason to think otherwise. And this was actually raised in a very interesting study of Laura Gilliam, whereby she studied the conflict in Northern Ireland with regards to how the conflict tends to be reproduced generation after generation. Generally, the fact that children learn the conflict over there before they actually learn the reason for the conflict, many would suggest that it's just the case of children passively imitating and reproducing the hatred of their parents. But what Gilliam suggests and points out, and she makes some very relevant observations, is the fact that they are brought up in an environment of violence, whereby they confront many situations of violence with the other group. So much so that it's not a case of them simply accepting what adults are telling them, but it's done in such a way that what they are being told actually makes sense to them, because they actually witness such instances of violence. So they make their own meaning and understanding of them. It's not a case of them just passively being told. It's something which they are coming to their own conclusions and understandings of, again, within the boundaries of their own adult structured existence, whereby in this particular case in Northern Ireland, they are restricted to certain spaces within the neighborhood according to their particular social groups. So it's interesting food for thought in that respect.
Well, I can see you're treading on delicate ground here, because you're trying to preserve both the agency of children and avoid a view which over ascribes communication and monitoring to the adult. But at the same time, you have to allow for structure in the situation. And the only, I mean, rather than, as it were, pressing you more on as what Peter, I think, was referring to was the Maltese content of this, I realize more study would be needed. And it's a very fascinating study, too. But the only other comment which, for me, arises from your reply, from your discussion, would be something like this. For me, Bourdieu's concept of habitus was his attempt to bring about an integration between, you know, freedom and structure, or agency and structure. But my own take on Bourdieu is that there's a heavy emphasis on imitation. There's a heavy emphasis on unconscious or subconscious or preconscious modes of imitation, and from that base of imitation, a little bit of innovation takes place. That's my way of looking at Bourdieu's habitus. It actually places much more attention to structure than to agency. So I'm inclined to look at your material and say that there is imitation of adults going on.
I had a very interesting discussion on habitus today. I didn't realize that concept has a strong medieval origin. What's interesting is that, you know, there's always an agency in structure. So where does the agency come from, and where does the structure come from? I mean, children, I think, even having worked with children myself in my work here in the faculty, children are exposed. I personally think it's more than simply some kind of, you know, like, it reminds me of Diana or something like that. It's the farce, the farsa. Because I think children are exposed to that. They're exposed to it, they don't have to go to the theater for that, because that's often organized in their communities, one of the local councils, activities, etc. So children will be exposed to that. Of course, however, they mediate. There are mediating influences. And this is where the child is a child. So we're never tabula rasa. There are always forces impinging upon us. But how we then make meaning out of that, and how do children make meaning of that, out of that, that's much more complex. So, you know, I mean, there's a complexity to be observed there. And I'm not probably the most qualified in terms of child psychology, for sure. There's definitely going to be exposure. There's going to be exposure, and there's always going to be, however, a mediating influence. So one wonders also, you know, whether sometimes what happens in plays like these are carryovers from what happens on the ground when they're playing with the children, with other children at school, where trading insults has always been part and parcel of our childhood, if I can talk about myself, you know?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, one of the things that struck me about this is, you know, I was saying to myself, well, how would English kids, you know, I have a bit of experience with English kids, and there would be some sort of insults, but there'd also be a certain type of emphasis on on sort of wordplay and sort of cleverness over there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one of the interesting things over there is that they are certainly picking up and they are negotiating their way. I mean, one of them says, you know, Hamala or something like this, or somebody aspires to be from England or whatever, you know, which is makes them upper class in their view. But, you know, so they're picking up a few things over here. And, I mean, they're negotiating, okay, amongst themselves, but they're also making statements about what they consider to be attractive or not, and so on and so forth. So, I don't know, something distinctive is taking place over here, it seems.
The influence of cartoons and TV. So you often get the trying to emulate, and I see this in children, I mean, family people, etc., trying to emulate, you know, try to come up with the clever American line, so to speak, which they pick up from a TV program. And, you know, kids, I've seen this in school to this morning, in fact. I go out on teaching practice to see student teachers. And you actually see them actually enacting amongst themselves, you know, throwing out this kind of, very Americanized kind of statement, which they obviously pick up from one of the cartoons they're watching. And that will probably play itself out in a semi-structured play like this.
In fact, it has been argued that such sort of media images are incorporated within the existence of the social world, which the children themselves are making sense of. So whilst family and the school and so on would form part of the adult structure of the existence, there are anthropologists who also argue that the social media, internet and television and so on, should also be included in this, particularly when it comes to children's enactment of their social agency in relation to their bodies, particularly when they undertake body work with one another, in essentially sort of coming up with their own understanding of where they stand in relation to other children's. And it's been proposed that social mediums such as the television and internet are also included within this, in as much as actual physical children are three-dimensional right in front of them.
Yes, well, I think it's this trying to puzzle over this fine line between agency and structure, between innovation and imitation, that there's more work to be done. And I think that is very, very, because what one thinks of these educational situations where you have the opportunity to watch kids, one always has to bear in mind that coming into any play situation, including the kind of semi-structured play which you have been analyzing, Sharon, I guess you have to say that kids bring into that play elements of their social desires and ambitions and their notion of an ideal reality, which they carry around with them in other contexts, you see. So one would also see that occurring. Their reality continues into the play, is sort of what I'm saying.
You know, we were questioning whether, to what extent they influence. I don't know if this connects with your research in the sense that, I don't know how to what extent you've observed this in the schools you've been, etc. But there's a phenomenon here which is quite global right now, and Malta is not immune to this. I know this because I've gone around schools, I raised this issue, and heads of schools tell me, well, come here and see them. The same thing happens here. I'm referring to what Henry Giroux, an American writer, refers to child nymphed fantasies in one of his pieces, where he talks about a process of oppression that children go through, often caused by their parents, because they get them to compete in child beauty contests. And what happens is that the children are conditioned, literally conditioned, like an animal in a circus, to adopt a particular walk. The catwalk, sort of, and that is something which is it's drilled into them, to the extent that you even see them at school walking in that particular way. And this is obviously in the international literature. What they comment about is that this has often led to even tragic consequences, pedophiles and whatnot, especially in the United States. But here in Malta, this is quite rampant. It's quite rife here in Malta, where parents actually. Now, here's the trading insights coming in. Parents actually transfer their own sense of achievement onto their children. The child becomes the instrument for their own sense of achievement to compete. To compete as a young singer, but more important, to compete as a young beauty paragon, whatever.
And, you know, it would be interesting to see in other research, if not in this one, to what extent the elements of this what I call accelerated adulthood, and child nymphed fantasies, are transferred into a semi-structured play. Because once those parents drum into the daughter, because it's often girls, that you are a young beauty queen, and you have to walk like one, and give them that sense of false sense of achievement, then, of course, being in a play in front of an audience means I am the actress. I have to emerge like a child beauty figure, and therefore this is an opportunity for me to show off this kind of approach. Hopefully others will rebel against that, of course, but, you know. So this is something, basically, I don't expect you to find this, but it's something which comes out of the international literature.
It does sound very interesting, to be honest, and I would like to look at that further and have a look at it. My initial reaction to it, though, the one which immediately springs to mind, and again, this without having any background on the reading whatsoever, but from what I can hear so far, it seems to be, again, that this is characteristic with many studies in this respect, that the focus is again on the adult and not the child, focusing specifically on what the adults are trying to do rather than what the children themselves are understanding from it. So the point which I essentially would want to stress in this respect, not necessarily arguing about the extent to which children might imitate their parents or otherwise, but specifically how children make meaning of these particular situations and what they're going through, because there is very often the mistaken assumption that they make the same meaning of a particular event as the adults. So what I would put forward is the fact that essentially you may be looking at the same thing but making two completely different meanings out of it. So what I would argue for is that we need to some degree, sort of shine a bit more of a spotlight on the child and what the children are actually understanding based on these particular situations, because there is quite a heavy focus as to what the adults themselves are trying to teach the children.
Or drum into them,
exactly. But we're not looking at what the kids are actually taking from that, how they are understanding it. More likely, we are actually presuming that what they understand from it is the same thing that the adults are trying to drum into them.
Exactly, and they, So how they, in this case, for example, how would the child use the space to resist this kind of imposition? Because it must have a different meaning.
Resist or comply with, really. I mean, this could be either or, because if again, they're brought up in this particular situation, it may be such that the encounters which they're experiencing make sense to them. They find absolutely no reason to contradict them in any way. But at the end of the day, the meanings which they make are still essentially theirs. It may comply with that of adults, it may not, but ultimately what I would argue for is that they must be recognized as social actors in their own right, who make their own meanings of these particular situations.
Sharon, thank you very much for what was in fact a stimulating paper, which is obviously leading to questions, and we really look forward to your further efforts and activity in the field of child research, and to see how you broaden the context and look at different contexts where children play or compete with each other. Thank you very much, Sharon.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Is This Play? Maltese Children's Negotiations of Play in a Drama Classroom. This talk was delivered by Ms. Sharon Attard, lecturer in the Anthropology of Children at the University of Malta.